Convene the Finance Committee. We now have a quorum present. As you notice from the agenda, our first order of business is introductions, and it looks like we may do two rounds of that as others join us. The snow is starting to come, so we may have a few that are running a little bit late. But maybe I'll just begin at my left here and ask Karen Clark, Representative Karen Clark, if you could introduce yourself, tell us what your district is, and what your role is with the committee if you happen to be a division chair, or in the case of the minority, a ranking member when we get to you. Okay. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Karen Clark, I represent three neighborhoods in South Minneapolis, inner city area, and I'm the chair of the Housing Policy and Finance and Public Health Finance Division for this committee. And actually, I just came this morning from a housing conference that where people were talking about some of the things that might come before this committee in terms of some of the issues of affordable housing and trying to deal with those issues. So, look forward to that kind of work.
Okay. We'll just go down the way, but Representative Houlson.
I represent a number of neighborhoods in the northwestern corner of St. Paul and the city of Falcon Heights, so city and suburb, four sides of the state fairground, independent of the state fair, and I share capital investment.
I'm Lauren Solberg. My district is 3B, which is all of Aiken County and parts of Itasca County, including the city of Grand Rapids, and I chair the Ways and Means Committee. For the ways to be mean.
I'm Bill Hilty. I represent District 8A, which is comprised of about half of Pine, most of Carlton, and a little bit of St. Louis counties. Currently, I chair the Energy Policy and Finance Division.
We'll just continue on. Just
okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Mary Kiffmeyer. I represent the majority of Sherburne County on the western side, and that includes the cities and townships of Big Lake, Becker, Zimmerman, city of Clear Lake, and township of Clear Lake, Baldwin, Palmer, and so on. So very rural area. Glad to be serving on this committee and glad to be here. Thank you.
One of my sons happens to live in your district.
Very good.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ron Szymanski, representing District 18A, which is McLeod and a portion of Meeker County, with the cities of Hutchinson, Glencoe, Winston, Lester Prairie, Plato, Broughton, Stewart, Silver Lake, and Cedar Mills. But we're a unique district. We're about 50 miles west of the metro area, and so a lot of my constituents are either farmers working in industry within our district or commuting into the metro area.
Gene Kowalski, Houston, Winona County.
We can hit the inside of the circle as we...
Kate Knuth, representing New Brighton, Arden Hills, and parts of Sorbian, Fridley.
And then on that side of the table, Representative Winkler, if you could introduce yourself and tell us what your district is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan Winkler, District 44B, St. Louis Park and Golden Valley. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I was late, but I was discussing the North Memorial Medical Center, which I hope you'll find to be a good excuse.
Well, being that it's in my district, I appreciate that. Thank you. Representative Biskin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Biskin. I represent District 35B, which is a large portion of Scott County, and I am the lead Republican on this committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Emmer. I'm the representative from District 19B, which is essentially the eastern half of Wright County, and I am following Representative Biskin.
Hi.
We'll just go right down the table.
I'm Joyce Pepin from House District 32A, which is Corcoran, Dayton, Greenfield, Hanover, Hasson, Rogers, and Maple Grove, and happy to be here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Simon, State Representative from District 44A, which is St. Louis Park and Hop. Good morning, Mr. Chair. Bobby Champion. I represent Senate District 58B, which is the southern portion of North Minneapolis, the North Loop, and a portion of downtown Minneapolis. And I am also the Vice Chair of Transportation Finance.
And one of the districts that borders with my own.
Absolutely.
When North Memorial was mentioned, I know often that's an area that's of interest to that whole corner there, North Minneapolis, Golden Valley, Robbinsville. So on.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Coles, since nobody else has laid claim, I'm happy to claim the greatest legislative district in the state of Minnesota, District 34A, which is central and western Carver County and part of Scott County. And as a high school student, Mr. Chairman, I think my parents helped fund the emergency room at North Memorial with several visits during my high school sporting days. I tended to get hurt more than actually perform well, so happy to have helped the economy in your part of the world at that time.
Another one of my sons, not the one that happens to live in Becker, by the way. He played football at Armstrong, started, never had an injury. But then went to a dance one night, slipped on the dance floor, and broke his wrist. That was the first time we used the emergency room at North Memorial.
Paul Teets in Richfield in South Minneapolis.
Okay, we have that's come over on this side. Representative Griling?
Susie Griling, Roseville, Lauderdale, St. Anthony Village.
And Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and sorry for being late. I think I did send in a request for informator on that. But anyway, I represent 43B, which is Minnetonka and Plymouth, and appreciate being on the committee.
And you are the vice chair of the committee?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and Representative Junkie?
Al Junkie from Wilmer, representing Candiola County. And I don't know how you people in this city live here and drive this traffic like this. Honest to God. Out in Wilmer, people at least keep moving. Here, it's like, well, anyway, I digress. That's why I'm late.
You must have encountered that snowstorm. Okay. From the standpoint of the committee staff, so you know who they are and what their roles are, I'll start with, I should introduce myself. Yeah, I'm Lynn Carlson, and my district is... as you might have been able to tell from the discussion referencing different other communities in the area, but I represent all the city of Robbinsville, a large part of Crystal, about a third of Golden Valley, and one precinct in New Hope. Lil, why don't you introduce yourself?
Lil Cookham.
And you are the
legislative assistant.
Okay, didn't mean to surprise you.
I'm Joanna Dornfeld, I'm the committee administrator.
And then we also have some caucus staff that's present, if they could stand and introduce themselves.
Dan King, GLP caucus. Dan White, GLP caucus.
Okay, and then we have House Research.
Kathy Novak, House Research.
And Fiscal Analyst Department.
Phil Marks, Fiscal Staff.
Okay, and then we have two pages. One of whom was with us last session, so he's a familiar face. Travis, if you could introduce yourself, maybe give a little bit of your background as well.
Yeah, my name is Travis Reese. I was a page last year, last semester, I was on finance and in higher education. This year I'm on finance and help with human services finance. So, this is the busy session, and I'm glad to be back. If you need anything, let me know. I'll be happy to help.
And our new page, Elizabeth.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Elizabeth. I grew up in St. Paul. This is my first time working in politics, so I'm really excited to be here. Such a passion is keeping me in the chance. With that, I can help you guys probably a little bit more knowledgeable about everything else.
Well, welcome. And to the committee members that are... new, welcome to the Finance Committee, and to those that were on the Finance Committee last session, welcome back. Did we miss anybody?
Nothing.
Who are you playing for? Oh, this side? Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's a building.
Okay. So, did we miss somebody? Oh, Representative Rod. We were just finishing introductions, so... You came in, and if you could tell us who you are, what district you represent, you've gone that routine before.
Sure, Representative Laura Broad, District 25A, southwest of Minneapolis, about 40 miles, the wonderful city of New Prague.
Okay, welcome. With that, we're going to have an overview of state agency financial audits, and we'll have Mr. Nobles and... Ms. Frickle will be the two that will do the initial presentation. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me is Cecile Furkel, who is the deputy legislative auditor for the Financial Audit Division. And we first want to thank you for taking time to visit with us this morning. I think it's particularly appropriate that we come before you on your first day. Although some of you may be wondering, since you're going to have to deal with some really big issues, big numbers, why would you want to start by dealing with the auditors who go out in the trenches and sometimes deal with the real details of financial management in state government? Well, I think at the very least, as you go off and deal with those big numbers, big issues, it's good for you to know that there are legislative auditors engaged in legislative oversight and accountability out there in the agencies on a day-to-day basis on your behalf. I think most of you are fairly familiar with us. You're all familiar faces from this committee or other committees where we've come and presented reports of various kinds. But there are a few of you that are new, and so let me start by just telling you a little bit about the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We are a nonpartisan office, a professional audit, evaluation, and investigative office for the legislative branch of Minnesota State Government. We are very much like what the GAO, or the Government Accountability Office, is for the United States Congress. We are your arm of legislative oversight and accountability, and we typically do deal with a lot of the details in state government. But some of you may be familiar with some of the other work that we do. We also have a program evaluation division within the office that does evaluation work specifically in response to your concerns and your requests. And we issue about 6 or 8 of these big blue cover reports every year, and those will start coming to you starting in just a few weeks. And those do typically deal with some of the policy and programmatic concerns that are of interest to the legislature. But as you know, and I think one of the reasons why we're here today, we also have a financial audit division, and Ms. Furkel is the deputy of that division. We are the auditor of Minnesota State Government. And we do a variety of things in our financial audit division. We, for example, audit the state's financial statements. This is something that we actually spend a good deal of time doing with our resources. We think this is a very important mechanism of accountability. This is the set of financial statements that credit rating agencies examine to give the state of Minnesota a credit rating. This is a set of financial statements compiled according to generally accepted accounting principles and audited every year. It's created, of course, by the Department of Finance, but audited every year by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. As I said, we spend a good deal of our time doing that work. It sometimes takes about half of our year because it's a very broad examination. We call it the statewide audit. We also, by the way, have responsibility under federal law to audit all of the federal funds that the state receives. That audit is referred to as the single audit. We also have responsibility in Minnesota law to audit on a regular basis certain entities, and so we have to figure that into our work as well. For example, we audit the state fair in Representative Hausman's district. We go there every year and audit their financial statements and their financial activities. And there are a variety of other organizations. We also audit all the constitutional offices. We do that twice during a term. We audit the governor, the attorney general, secretary of state, the attorney general's office. That takes up a certain amount of our time. So when we are left with nothing else to do, we have 165 to 180 different entities in state government that we have responsibility to get to on some periodic basis. That's everything from the Department of Transportation to the Barbers Board to the Combative Sports Commission. And so we have to look at all of those organizations that we have responsibility for and periodically see what staff we have available and go through a risk assessment and determine which of those organizations we're going to audit on an annual, in each year. And we then, of course, have to determine what is going to be within the scope of any one of those audits, because when we go over to the Department of Transportation, for example, or the Department of Health, we can't audit everything. And so we have to define specifically what are we going to look at.
And I think we are here today to talk about the recent audit reports that we've released that are a part of that effort to go into the state agencies and look at them in some detail. And frankly, we have found a real pattern of problems in these recent audits that we think go beyond just looking at the individual entities. Of course, ultimately, the administrators of each of these entities is responsible for correcting the problems that we have found. And I think we have a good working relationship with each of these departments and the commissioners and the deputy commissioners and assistant commissioners and all the people there. And they are responsive to our concerns and our findings and our recommendations. But as we looked at these this year, we said we are having more findings in state government. And some of them are about the very basic business functions of state government. Making timely deposits, protecting assets, getting proper authorizations for payments. And so we saw an increased number of findings as we went in and did these audits. And we think that while we perform a very vital and important function in going in and doing these audits, we really live by the creed that although we are certainly an essential part of getting good government for the people of the state of Minnesota, we can't do it alone. We can't audit our way to good government. We have to have allies, particularly in the executive branch, to help us. First, we have to have the people in the agencies being responsive to our concerns and our recommendations. But we think we need more than that. And so in recent meetings that we've had, we are really looking to the Department of Finance. The Commissioner of Finance is the Chief Financial Officer of the state. And we think that the Department of Finance, now called the Minnesota Office of Management and Budget, really needs to take a stronger leadership position in ensuring that all of the financial activities of state government are being conducted under tight internal controls, that there is a real focus on those basic business functions, so that we don't, next year and the year after, have a series of reports with a significant number of findings that we have today. So with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I think I want to call on Cecile Ferkel for an overview. We don't intend to talk about any one of these reports in any great detail. We are going to be coming to some of your committees. We've been invited to come and speak specifically about some of these audit reports, where committees have jurisdiction over these entities. But we want to give you a sense of the pattern of problems that we're finding. And I guess I'd like to leave you with one more message from my perspective. We know that the biggest challenge you face in this session is a huge, enormous budget crisis. And we understand that part of solving that is going to be cutting budgets. But we do ask you to remember that even after you make those cuts, state government is still going to be a very large, very complicated financial enterprise. And there are business functions throughout state government being conducted by state employees, and they need to be conducted well. So as we cut budgets, let's remember that good financial management is more than just cutting budgets. It's making sure that after we cut those budgets and are still a financial enterprise that is engaging in hundreds, thousands of financial transactions on a daily basis, and ultimately any given year spending still billions of dollars of taxpayer money, we need to really emphasize the basic business functions in state government to ensure that they are well done. So again, Mr. Chairman and members, to tell you why we're here and why we have concerns, I'd like to call on Cecile Ferkel to make a few additional remarks.
You're welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for having us here today. I want to call your attention to something that's in your folder. It's the Audit Risk Alert 2008. I'm going to be kind of using that as my framework for the discussion today. What's in this document is our assessment of some of the common weaknesses that we've seen throughout this group of audits. And it was prepared mainly for a manager's conference of state managers that I went to try to spread some of our concerns to agencies that we haven't been to audit, to let them know, too, what we're finding in the audits that we did conduct. So looking at that as a basis, there are a few areas of concern that we really consider to be basic, fundamental internal controls. And internal controls within an entity are the way that the organization makes sure that things are operating the way that they should. And the first of those areas is incompatible duties. And that's the idea that no one person should be able to handle a transaction from beginning to end. And obviously when we're in big agencies where there are thousands of employees, hundreds of employees, you would think that it would be a fairly easy task to find a way to separate duties in the major functions of maybe receiving revenues or making payments. But part of our concern is that we're seeing agencies where that separation of duties is not really being monitored as well as we would like. Some of that separation of duties happens in the way that somebody's access to an accounting system is granted, and we do see agencies that are not monitoring when they've allowed someone the access to do various duties that are incompatible. So perhaps they're giving somebody in the accounting system the ability to process purchases. They're also giving them the ability to receive those goods and to make that payment. That creates an environment where errors may not be detected, but our concern we have, too, is that it also creates an environment where fraud could occur. Incompatible duties also can exist just in what people do day to day. And we see that as well, that there are people that are responsible for collecting the cash and preparing the deposit and bringing it to the bank, and then recording it in the accounting system and doing the reconciliation. So again, those are the kinds of duties that in operation, a financial operation, you would want to separate as a way to make sure that errors are detected and that the opportunity for fraud is diminished. Another area that we were concerned about was safeguarding of receipts. And the first time that this really hit our radar was when we did the audit of the Department of Health, where they collect a variety of different kinds of licensing receipts. And we found that they had a very decentralized process where the receipts would come in the mail and then they'd be dispersed to about 35 different areas within the building where they are then recorded, and those various areas are responsible for making sure they get in the bank and they comply with the statutes as far as getting them in the bank timely. So we saw a lot of weaknesses in that process, again, both in terms of separation of duties, but also in safeguarding and keeping track of where the money went, who did it go to, and who's getting it in the bank, and did it get in the bank. We saw some control or lack of controls there that really concerned us. But not only at that department, the thing that we found was that many of the departments that we looked at had very weak controls over safeguarding of their assets. One agency that we went to, they had a little plastic box at the reception desk right off the elevators where the money would go, and that's how $100 million, I might have my numbers wrong, but I think it's $100 million, is collected and ultimately gets in the bank. It's through this little pink plastic box at the reception desk that really was not well secured. So we saw some things that really surprised us, and we saw some things that concerned us in a variety of operations. And then going from a really big agency down to the smaller ones, we saw at the Barbers and Cosmetology Board, too, that they did not have adequate separation of duties. And when they tried to recently reconcile their collections to their licenses issued, they identified that about $10,000 had never gotten into the bank. And because of the lack of controls, the lack of responsibility for custody of that cash, they really have been unable to identify exactly where it went. It's likely that it was a fraud on the part of one of their employees. And we're talking about a small operation here where there are three people responsible for the cash. So it really highlights in a big organization or a small organization, you really need to have these controls in place. And most recently for us, the Combative Sports Commission, where we found them collecting receipts on site at a fight. I said this was a whole new world for me, going out and understanding the fight world was kind of, I never thought I'd do that as a part of this job. But they go to the fights and they're regulating them, and they may be collecting license fees or event fees right there. And they told us, you know, it goes in someone's pocket and gets brought to the office on Monday. You know, that's just not the way a state agency should be run, whether it's two people or 100 people or 5,000 people. The controls over these assets of the state really need to be improved. Another area that we look at is payroll. Payroll is about $3.5 billion of state expense, and we were concerned about many state agencies have moved to an electronic payroll system where each employee enters their time electronically, the supervisor signs off on it electronically, and it interfaces with the state's payroll system. Our concern was that departments were really not monitoring those approvals, how they had set those up, who was responsible for signing off on people's time, and then also not monitoring when exceptions to the normal process were occurring. So, you know, when $3.5 billion pretty much from the point that you press the button just rolls up and gets paid, we felt that some of those initial controls were really, really important. Another payroll area outside of the electronic self-service time entry that concerned us was the payroll and overtime at the Minneapolis Vets Home. That was one that really surprised us, and that might be a report that if you do have an opportunity you may want to read, where we saw identified, just for the sake of providing an example, 9 people that were receiving a huge amount of overtime. Sometimes the overtime they received exceeded their normal pay. And the lack of controls in terms of supervisors authorizing that overtime, somebody reviewing their timesheets, somebody monitoring it even to see, you know, how much are we spending and where might our problems be. We really felt that was not being looked at. And when we kind of ran the numbers on it, we found that there were, in this group of people that had charged 30 to 70 additional hours every 80-hour pay period, so sometimes almost doubling their hours, every single pay period over a 3-year period. That's a lot of overtime. If they were actually working it, you worry about the care that people may be getting, but you also have to really wonder, were they working the hours they were paid for? Because of the poor controls, we really didn't have any way to validate or invalidate those numbers other than that it seemed unreasonable to us. After the review of the Sonia Pitt investigation at the Department of Transportation, which I would assume you're all familiar with, we decided in this group of audits to focus on several areas, and one of those was cell phones. And we, part of the Sonia Pitt investigation, the cell phone records were a way to determine, you know, where she was and what she was doing. And it was a lack of review of those cell phone records within the department that was a concern to us also. As we looked at cell phones throughout these other audits, we found very isolated examples of any state agency doing a good review and oversight of cell phones. Kind of, you know, on one hand, you'd say, well, cell phones are not a big expense. And if somebody uses 2 or 3 hours, they're still below their minutes, and they're, you know, it's really not worth the effort to monitor and control cell phone use. And I certainly understand that, but one of the dynamics of cell phones is that the federal government has some fairly specific regulations about how a government must oversee cell phone use of their employees. And if those regulations aren't followed, those cell phones then are a personal benefit to the employee and they need to be taxed. Well, those cell phones are not being taxed by the state, and we found pretty much across the board that no state agency is monitoring cell phone use in accordance with the IRS regulations. The IRS has been, over the last couple of years, taking a more active role in overseeing compliance with their regulations, and they have been fining governments. And there's a college, I think it was UCLA out in California, that was fined $250,000 because they were not enforcing compliance with the cell phone policy. So that really, you know, is more of the exposure is, are we at risk of being penalized because state agencies are not monitoring cell phone use? Travel was another area that we focused on after the Sonia Pitt investigation. We wanted to see how other agencies are monitoring, authorizing, controlling travel expenditures. And in-state travel in fiscal year 2008 was about $40 million for state employees that are traveling within the state, about another $14 million for state employees that are traveling outside of the state. So in terms of the overall state budget, not a big dollar, but again, it's something that we have found fairly weak controls at some agencies. As we went out and did these audits, we again found that there seemed to be some lack of oversight by managers and by the departments about how travel expenses were being reimbursed to employees, what travel was being approved, what kinds of documentation were being required. So travel again was something that we felt needed some attention before reimbursements were eliminated. We found one agency, one employee within the Department of Labor and Industry who routinely increased mileage that he claimed when he traveled. He's an inspector, travels pretty much all the time, pretty much full-time traveling around the state. And, you know, mileage is reimbursed at about 50 cents a mile. He overstated his mileage to the extent that he got $10,000 of additional reimbursement for mileage by claiming more miles than, you know, the actual distance would be. That's a lot of mileage for a supervisor to not have noticed, for a department to not have noticed, and those are the kinds of oversight and controls that we're seeing the need for improvement in. And quite a few of our audits, about a third of our audits, we encountered situations where we asked for information and the documentation was not available. Sometimes, certainly reasonable type of explanations. We moved our offices, we can't find those records, or it's something that Sally maintained and she retired and we don't know where it is. But being able to provide evidence for the state's financial activity we feel is a very important responsibility for state government. And really there's not much that gets an auditor's attention more than finding out that there's no documentation to support a transaction. We pretty much put our little radars up and we say what's really going on here and we start to look deeper. So we are concerned that state agencies, you know, a third of the state agencies didn't have some documentation that we needed. And we're not talking about maybe, I mean, sometimes we are talking about just the invoice to support a payment, but there was a state agency that didn't have 6 months' worth of support for purchase card transactions that their employees had incurred, about $70,000 worth of transactions, where employees have a credit card and they go out and buy things for the agency, but there was no support to show what was bought and who bought it and was it authorized. It seems to have just been a filing error, but that's all we have to go on. So those are the types of things that we've been encountering. And, you know, we certainly can keep going into one agency after another and continue to find these. But I think our focus right now is how can we try to use the results of these audits in ways that can help other state agencies to make some improvements, even if we're not there doing an audit. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, as I said, we do get down into the details. And but, you know, as I'd just like to echo what Ms. Burkle said at the end, and that is our job here is not just to have findings. It's to achieve good government and financial integrity in the operations of state government. We're not going to do that by audits alone. So, again, we're looking for allies and partners, and specifically we're looking for the Department of Finance to start emphasizing these as preventive measures so that we don't have a reoccurrence of all of these findings. But, again, Mr. Chairman, thank you, and would be prepared to answer any of your questions.
Ms. Nobles, you've uncovered the problems, and my question is, I assume then that the agencies have agreed to make the corrections, and how are we assured or you assured that those corrections, in fact, are made? And then the second part of my question, you threw out some pretty large amounts. When somebody overbills the state, do we collect that money back then, or what's the next step in the process? Maybe that's a question for Ms. Ferkel, but the first question maybe for you, Mr. Noble.
Well, Mr. Chairman, let me answer the question about follow-up in terms of getting money back, because we do specifically have a statutory responsibility to report any misuse of state funds to the Attorney General. And the Attorney General can either by informal action or even civil lawsuit try to recover funds, and that does occur. We work quite closely with the Attorney General on those efforts. Where there is any possible evidence of criminal wrongdoing, and in some of the things that we find there is, Ms. Burkle mentioned the loss of funds at the Barber's Board, we do believe that that was a theft. And so we work with county attorneys, depending on the area of jurisdiction. Typically it's Ramsey County, sometimes it's Hennepin County. But as you know, the county attorneys in the state of Minnesota have responsibility for bringing criminal prosecution. And we certainly encourage that. We will certainly cooperate in any way we can to bring criminal action against anyone that steals money from the state. So how do we know, aside from
the actions of the Attorney General or county attorneys, whether or not agencies have implemented our recommendations. Well, there is follow-up. It's been a long-standing follow-up effort by the Department of Finance. I think it was instituted by Governor Arnie Carlson to write a letter to every commissioner after we issue one of our financial audit reports indicating that the governor and the commissioner of finance expect those recommendations to be implemented and those issues to be attended to. And then there's a periodic reporting. And typically, there is action. How do we know for sure that the problem has been corrected? Well, we don't completely because our resources are stretched fairly thin. We probably won't get back to that agency to specifically examine that particular issue for possibly some years later. So again, that's why we are looking for allies within the daily function of state government to ensure that not just that specific problem was corrected. We want people to look beyond that and implement internal controls throughout the organization so that similar problems will not occur. What we don't want is for agencies to say, for example, well, the auditors came in and they found that Bill over here went off on a trip and submitted some reimbursements and he got those, and later the auditors determined, maybe as Ms. Ferkel referred to, that the mileage was inflated. We don't want the agency to say, well, that was just a problem with Bill, and so we talked to Bill about it, and he doesn't do that anymore. We see sometimes these problems as indicative of broader problems that need to be addressed. One of the things that I think disturbs us, frankly, is when there is a problem, and it could be from a lack of documentation to a fraud. When we simply say, well, that's a problem of one employee, or that's a bad apple, that's a rogue employee, we don't think these things happen just because there's a rogue employee. We think they happen because there's a lack of good internal controls. Some of you, for example, recently read about a fraud at the Department of Human Services, a significant fraud of possibly as much as $1 million. What we have heard in some discussions is, well, that was just a bad employee. We know something about how that occurred, and it was indeed a bad employee, but it was also weak control. So again, we take these episodes as examples of problems that need to be corrected, not only for the individual, but for the organization as well.
Representative Solberg.
Chairman, thank you. Ms. Ferkel, you stated that when you were talking about the payroll that, I can't remember exactly how you were stated, but you said, well, when it was, you were talking about overtime, and the lack of supervision of that, but that it wasn't with, what are some of the exceptions to those normal things that you would normally see? What are those exceptions to normal things that you would look for in the payroll?
Mr. Chair, representative, exceptions in the payroll process.
Well, you were talking about the payroll process, and you said, Mr. Chair, that, Ferkel, that sometimes there were, you know, things should be brought up except for exceptions to the normal process.
Mm-hmm.
What would be those exceptions to the normal process that you would think would be okay to do?
Right.
Ms. Ferkel.
Mr. Chair, Representative, what we're talking about is in the electronic environment. The department sets up a certain structure where they identify a certain supervisor who's authorized to approve the payroll for specific employees. And it should be a supervisor who knows what that employee does, who has some control or oversight of that employee. But, of course, because people are not always at work, always, you know, on payday, they have to have a backup person. There's, in this electronic environment, there are two exceptions that end up getting kicked out on a report every pay period. One is where it's a backup person authorizing that person's time. And the other is where the employee, him or herself, did not actually hit the final button on the time for the timesheet, didn't do the final approval. So the risk is that, you know, an employee knows what they do, so they're the best person to report on time. The risk is that if somebody else is reporting that time, there may be errors or exceptions.
And again, the supervisor, the primary supervisor, is the person who best knows how that employee spent their time, should be the one authorizing the timesheet. So if a backup person approves it, there's that, again, is a weaker environment. Every pay period, a report is produced that lists out those exceptions, and ideally an agency should have a fairly small amount of exceptions. But we have found agencies that aren't aware that report is being produced. They aren't aware of those controls and why they exist. They aren't aware that there may be a problem with a backup supervisor approving time for someone they don't have direct responsibility for their actions. So now perhaps a timesheet is being prepared by, not by the employee and approved by a backup supervisor, and that's the basis for the payroll that's being paid. That's not an ideal situation. The department has a responsibility, according to state policy and the way the system was set up, to follow up on those situations. Again, we don't see departments following up on the situations or documenting the resolution of those items. So that was what I was referring to.
Just a follow-up then. I'm looking at the Minnesota Vets Home, and there are four things that you found this time that were prior findings.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably more disturbing than anything, because most of the other reports that come through, you never see a prior finding that comes through a second time. To follow up a little bit on the chair's question, what happens?
Mr. Chairman and members, we are going to be discussing this particular report, by the way, with the several committees in both the House and Senate. But to specifically address your question and concern, Representative Solberg, we find it hard to explain, frankly, how there can still, at this late date, after so much attention and focus on that facility, how you can find these kinds of basic problems. You're looking for an explanation. I can't give you a good one. There is nothing that I'm aware of that explains this in any reasonable way. It is just inattention to good financial management. It's inexcusable, especially, as I say, for an organization that has been so much under the spotlight. But we will be discussing that report and those issues in more detail before various House and Senate committees.
Just Bob, what's the time frame between your first finding and this one on that organization?
What was the time frame?
Oh, between the Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe it was 3 years, a 3 year period.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hoffman.
I have been just very impressed with the quality and independence and often even courage that this office has shown in its work, and I've just been incredibly impressed by that. I'm wondering, is this common in all 50 states, that there is such an independent voice, or did some visionary in our past understand the need?
Mr. Chairman and members, Representative Hausman, well, it is fairly common. Most states have a legislative audit office, similar to the one in Minnesota. Some states also, as we do in Minnesota, have an elected auditor as well, and there are a few states that just have an elected auditor. As I said, the model that we have in Minnesota is patterned much after the one at the federal level, with the U.S. Congress having an audit office, independent, nonpartisan. There were indeed visionaries in Minnesota. Some of you were here at that time. I myself was here at the time when there was a good deal of reform of the financial activities of state government and a lot of effort to strengthen the ability of the legislative branch to also be a part of a good financial management oversight and accountability. And actually, the creation of the Office of the Legislative Auditor came about in 1972 at the recommendation of an organization called the Loan Executive Action Program, which was an organization created by Governor Wendell Anderson to really look in great detail at the activities of state government and specifically at some of the financial management concerns. And they made two major recommendations. One, to create a Department of Finance. Previously, the budget and the financial affairs of the state were part of the Department of Administration. And LEAP, Loan Executive Action Program, felt that
the state's financial activities were becoming large enough, complicated enough, that the budget and the financial management of state government really needed more focus, and so they made that recommendation, and it was adopted, and that's when the Department of Finance was created. The second important recommendation that LEAP made, and was again accepted, was that you should create a legislative audit office to extend the arm of legislative oversight and accountability into the agencies on your behalf. You come here, and as I said in my preface, you deal with big decisions, big numbers, big policy choices, and in the end, you appropriate billions of dollars. And you do a lot of oversight through your committees and through the work that you do as individual legislators, and that's very much important. But there are some things that need to be done on a more detailed basis by accountants, by evaluators, by investigators, with very specific authority to engage in that kind of oversight. And so you created this office. It's been in existence now for a number of years. And I think what we bring before you today is evidence of why that was an important decision for the legislature to make. And having been the legislative auditor now for a number of years, I do want to say to you that it isn't just us that makes this possible. It is you as well. You created the law, but you also protect and defend the independence of this office. I know that sometimes we produce reports, both financial audit reports, investigative reports, and evaluations that some of you don't agree with. But I must say that I've never had one of you come to me and say that you were going to do away with us or you're going to do any harm to us because we produced something that you didn't like. I think you understand and respect the need for this function and the independence. Now, you may say some of those things among yourself, but it is really important for you to know that you are a partner in having this office as an arm of nonpartisan, independent legislative oversight and accountability. I work, as you know, directly for the Legislative Audit Commission. I'm appointed for a six-year term. That was, again, I think, an element of creating the independence that is necessary, that the legislative auditor does serve a fixed term. And as I think, again, and some of you are currently and have been members of the Legislative Audit Commission, you know that it is one of the commissions in the legislative branch that is, by law, bipartisan. There are six House members, three Republicans, three Democrats, six senators, three Democrats, three Republicans. So this function is viewed as an institutional function of the legislative branch. And the expectation is, and always has been and should remain, that it is a professional, independent, nonpartisan function. And that's what we try to live up to. So we do appreciate your support.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I could, you indicated that in the case of one agency, it didn't seem to have changed behavior, but could one reasonably assume that an audit like this has the potential to change behavior because people do know somebody's watching?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Houseman, I do think that there is a deterrent effect from the work that we do, and we try to ensure that people are aware in state government. Frankly, and this is, I think we all have mixed feelings about this, that sometimes there is a certain amount of media coverage for what we find through our audits and investigations. And frankly, it pains me that sometimes our work is used by some to depict that state government is much more poorly managed than it really is. And you have a situation like Sonia Pitt, for example, where there is a good deal of publicity about the misbehavior of this one state employee. But I'd like to look at those kinds of situations in a very different way. I'd like to say that here we have a situation which was painful and difficult, but we uncovered it, and we dealt with it in a very open and transparent way. And so while, yes, it brings a certain amount of bad publicity, shall we say, and gives reason for some to think that state government is really poorly managed and that there are a lot of Sonia Pitts. But, you know, again, I think it is important that we find those situations, that we disclose them, but that, as I said before and will repeat probably many times, What we're trying to do here is not just disclose problems, not just have findings, but we're trying to work our way toward a good government that has a reputation for very strong integrity and good financial management. I think we've hit a lapse in that, that we have an opportunity to now correct, and we ought to correct very quickly.
Representative Hausman, is that? In your response to Representative Hausman, you mentioned the LEAP program, and you and I may be the only two in the room that go back to the LEAP program. If you could just very briefly mention what it was.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there may be a few others of us here, but I know we were here at the time, and it really was an excellent effort because it did, as the name implies, it brought in executives from the private sector. It wasn't the typical sort of blue ribbon effort where people come in and hear testimony and presentations. These people came in and actually worked in state government on a day-to-day basis, observing and seeing in detail what is the operation, what are the functions of state government. They were here for months. And in 1972, as I recall, they issued a number of reports, very detailed reports, about how state government could be improved by restructuring, by improving some procedures and processes. Again, as I mentioned before, it was set up by Governor Wendell Anderson. But it also occurred at a time, I think, when the legislature was really improving and strengthening its part in state government. And that was a very important moment, I think, when the legislature started to hire professional staff. That's how I came to work for the legislature in 1972 and worked at House Research. When I first came in that year, I think most of us could, at House Research could get in one car and go to lunch together. But it has since then expanded. The legislature also took on the revisor's office during that time, hired fiscal staff, and as I said, also created the Office of the Legislative Auditor. So I think both LEAP and efforts to strengthen the role of the legislature in state government really came together, and I think it's had some good effect.
Yeah, and I wasn't here when it was established, but I was elected in 72, so when those reports came forward for the 73 session, I think it's fair to say we adopted the vast majority of those recommendations from the various reports that came to the various committees at the time. We've got four people that have indicated they have a question, and then I think I'll stop at that point because we do want to hear a response from the Minnesota Management and Budget, or what we used to call Department of Finance. We have next Representative Simon, then Winkler, then Solberg, and then Tepin, and then we'll revert to the department for their comments. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, a quick plug, then a question. I happen to sit, as you know, on the Legislative Audit Commission, and I don't think we thank you enough for the work that you do. I've learned in 4 years of being here that we don't do oversight in the legislature particularly well, not because we're lazy or uninterested, it's because we don't have the time. And we're here for 4.5 months a year in the long session, and our committees are bill factories. They're not meant to do extended oversight like Congress, where they'll go weeks at a time without hearing a bill in committee and just do oversight. So we just don't have the time often, and we rely very heavily on you and others to bring to our attention these lapses or these opportunities for reform. So thank you for doing that. And this year, obviously, the stakes are higher probably than ever, because when our constituents hear about even $10,000 of someone padding their mileage, they get upset, they get angry. And if we're trying to, and they have a right to. And so if we're trying to strive for maximum taxpayer value, this is the way to get it. This is a way to get it. So I guess what I wanted to ask you, you talked about allies, and that you're going to be working with the Department of Minnesota Management and Budget in order to correct some of these internal controls. Are we one of those allies? And if so, what legislation, comprehensive legislation, if any, do you recommend that we seek in order to remedy the problem? And maybe the answer is none. Maybe the answer is we don't need another law in the books. We can get this done through internal rules and controls with Minnesota Management and Budget. But is there a comprehensive, you know, bill or set of bills that you think would get at this problem? Or is it just a question of, hey, we ought to get out of the way and let you handle it or someone else handle it?
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Simon, there are several parts to my response. One, as I was coming over here, I just noticed, for example, that Senator Ress, also a member of the Legislative Audit Commission, has introduced a bill along the lines of our discussion today. She would require the Commissioner of Finance to track implementation of recommendations by the Legislative Auditor to ensure that they are implemented. As I mentioned, that is something that already occurs by practice. She would make that a matter of law if that were to pass. She would also explicitly make the Commissioner of Finance or Director of the Office of Management and Budget responsible for ensuring that every state employee who has responsibility for accounting and financial management has training in internal controls. And I think that would be a good thing to do as well. Should that already be occurring? Yes, and is to some degree. But again, I think we're at a point where we need to make that a very explicit legal requirement and tell the Commissioner of Finance or Director of the Office of Management and Budget, however that terminology works itself out, that he or she is indeed the Chief Financial Officer of this state and has some level of shared responsibility with all of the agencies and departments to ensure good financial integrity. So I think those things are good. Are you an ally? Absolutely. Because the decisions that you make about what you require in the law, for example, is very important. The more explicit you can be about your expectations, about how agencies operate, how they spend money, the more you help us when we go in and do control and compliance audit work. Sometimes one of the difficulties we have is that there is some ambiguity in the law. I mean, as I said before, I worked on your side of the table in years past, and I understand that sometimes it's difficult to craft legislation to be absolutely clear. But to the degree that you can make your expectations clear in law, that really helps us as the arm of legislative oversight and goes in and, to some degree, does battle with the executive agencies, that may be a little too strong a term, over whether or not they are complying with your expectations. The clearer you are, the better. Final thing, maybe two other things. One is just having this hearing is helpful. Just putting a focus on these issues. Again, when we understand that you have to deal with an enormous problem, big numbers, big policy issues, for you to hold this hearing and say these things matter, that's important and that's helpful. The final thing is difficult, and that is in the context of cutting budgets. I think what I oftentimes hear is that the main thing the citizens want, and the main thing, therefore, sometimes gets translated into where you cut the budget, is just cut the bureaucrats in St. Paul. And I understand that, but as I said before, even after you do all the cuts, and even if you do several billion dollars in cuts, state government will still be one of the largest, most complicated financial enterprises in the state of Minnesota. It is an incredibly complicated financial enterprise to operate. It needs people. It needs good professionals. And so as you're cutting into the budgets of state agencies, I think it, at least be mindful of whether or not you're reducing some organization from three account clerks down to one, so that maybe this issue of separation of duties is going to be all the more difficult. Again, I understand the challenge that you face. The state government has taken some pretty significant cuts over the last several years and will undoubtedly have to take more. And so just be mindful that running this big financial enterprise does take people. It takes talented, good professional people. And so let's at least be left with some of them to run this big financial enterprise once we're done.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Nobles, thank you. Phyllis, Representative Kahn is not here today, but I'll speak, I guess, on behalf of her committee, which had jurisdiction over the legislative budget as well as the Department of Finance and other agencies. And we do intend to have a series of hearings as well on what you're finding and the role of the auditor in audit function generally in state government. You have talked about the fact that you rarely find that a single employee is the bad apple, but rather the bad apple is given opportunity because of a systemic failure in some way or another. The question I have in looking at this list of agencies that you have reviewed and found concerns with is whether the individual agency problem is not just one bad agency or one bad incident at an agency, but it's a systemic problem across state government. You did mention an emerging pattern, and so I wonder if you could expand a bit on that and have any ideas as to why we're seeing this pattern emerge now. It's very hard for us, I guess, to take any kind of concrete action without a better understanding of what might be driving this.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Winkler, and certainly Cecile, if you have some additional comments, I'd welcome those. But I think we can't give you the exact cause. I mean, certainly I think there's some concern that budget cuts have had an impact. But I want to quickly add, because I mentioned budget cuts earlier, we never allow an agency to excuse their problems on budget cuts. You know, we've had budget cuts, but in the end, we have to do our job, and we have to do it up to the expectations of the public and you. So, in the end, agencies have got to find a way to get the job done, but certainly there have been a lot of budget cuts in the operations of state agencies. I think, frankly, for me, as I look at the situation, I think it's in part because there just has not been enough emphasis on good basic financial management in state government. We have a lot of focus on kind of the big program and policy issues. You do that, the administration does that, and we understand that's where most of your discussion will take place. But I don't think that there has been enough focus and emphasis on some of the issues that we've raised, starting in the governor's office, into the commissioner's offices, down to the deputies, the assistants. This is something that needs to be infused from the top all the way through state government, that these things really matter. Now, do we expect the governor or you to be concerned about the details of internal controls at the barber's board? Not really. But we do expect all of us as leaders in state government to send the message down to the people at the barber's board that we do care and that we do have a high expectation about how state government is going to be run. Let me cite just one other example that is a bit of a pet peeve to me, and that is a recent audit that we conducted of the Combative Sports Commission. Now, you could look at that one and say, well, ultimately, what does that really matter? It's not a lot of money, not a lot of people. Who really cares? My point is, that is state government. You created it. The governor appointed the executive director and the board members, and they went off and did just about everything imaginable wrong because they weren't given the proper support within state government to establish a website, to collect the cash, to put it in the bank, to do all of the basic functions that you need to do when you are state government. And they are state government. They are exercising the powers of the law that you passed. They are exercising the powers that the governor gave the executive director by appointing him to be executive director. It isn't appropriate for us just to sort of cast them adrift and let them create a website that was completely infected with viruses because they had no home in state government. Because on that website, people who interact with state government are required to give state government very personal health information. And it is completely unsecured. That is still state government, just like the Department of Transportation or the Department of Health. And so one of the systemic problems, Representative Winkler, is that we have such a fragmented system of government. As I said, we can count up 160, 165, 180 different entities spread all around state government and literally spread all around the territory of the state of Minnesota and particularly in the metropolitan area. A little commission, a little board here and there, very sometimes loosely connected to the expectations, the prerogatives, the rules, the laws of how a state agency is supposed to operate. We really need to correct that as a systemic problem.
Representative Winkler, did you have a follow-up?
Mr. Chair, I'll just say that there will be time for more extensive follow-up in other committees, I suspect, but I guess just one comment would be that perhaps we have too many of these entities out there, and the amount of financial oversight and expertise that each small agency needs to have is something that we should consider in consolidating budgets this year.
And as Mr. Nobles pointed out, the intent here was to have an overview in the entire Finance Committee to raise the level of awareness, and there will be follow-up hearings in the relevant divisions and committees and so on, where that one report that he held up to give an idea of the detail that's contained in those will take place. We're going to...
Representative Winkler's point?
Representative
Lucavina. No. I represent Winkler. I mean, since both of the examples the legislative auditor gave were in my division, I feel compelled to...
So you'll have the follow-up.
A little bit. But, you know, both of these agencies cited were just recently combined to become efficient. And so sometimes, you know, when you combine agencies and become efficient and you change things around here, it has the exact opposite effect. So, again, you know, being as involved as you were in the I-35 bridge, Representative Winkler, when you run down the line of the chief, bad things happen. And I think that has a lot to do with what we're doing. And oftentimes, reform is not only not the answer, but it has the exact opposite effect. And I think in both of these cases, in fact, when we combine and modernize, I guess, the combative course and combine the cosmetology course by taking it out of commerce and putting it in with the barbers, we got less efficient, and that was the result.
Could I, we've got one more person, Representative Solberg, and if it can be a brief question, and then...
Mr. Chairman, mine will be very quick.
From Mr. Nobles,
just a quick answer to Mr. Nobles. Are any of these problems related to the accounting system itself? And we know that that's going to be changed a little bit, and if there are, have you looked at solutions?
Mr. Chairman,
just very brief, I do want to get the Department of Finance.
Mr. Solberg, I don't think we can blame the accounting system, but the accounting system needs improvement, but these problems in and of themselves are not the fault of the accounting system.
Okay, very good.
Okay, thank you both, and as was indicated, there will be follow-up on these issues. We now have Minnesota Management and Budget before us for a brief response, and one of you is Ms. Moll. Any other, Ms. Andrews? If you could identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Stephanie Andrews, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Finance, which we hope to officially rename Minnesota Management and Budget soon so we can all stop going back and forth. Thank you for having us here today to respond to the concerns raised by the OLA. We're glad to have the discussion, and we hope that we can continue to work with them and with you to strengthen financial management in the executive branch. We take the concerns raised in the reports very seriously, too, as do the agencies whose reports you've been looking at. I think for context, maybe we'll start out just briefly talking about the roles of the executive branch agencies, M&D, just to give a sense, as Representative Winkler talked about. We will be talking about this in more detail, but just want to give you an overview. At M&D, we work closely with agencies to develop policies and procedures. We help review their spending plans. We provide training on an ongoing basis. And not incidentally, we also operate and maintain the major systems that allow them, that are the key tools for them in their financial management work. So the state's accounting system, the state's payroll system, information access, which is the data warehouse that runs off of both of those systems. But agencies still maintain primary responsibility for their financial controls under statute and policy. And so that's one of the things that we take pretty seriously, too. It's certainly a partnership. We try to make sure that they're aware of what the practices are, that will lead to the best financial management. We work with them very closely, and when we need to, we step in. But we're also, again, always trying to balance that relationship with them so that we can all meet the standards that we're hoping to meet. Agencies also need very different kinds of support. I think you heard that from some of the concerns raised by the OLA across those range of reports. Larger agencies, we often work with them in looking at some of the more complex transactions and complex activities that they are looking to make sure that they've set up a system that will meet their goals and meet the highest standards of financial integrity. Smaller agencies often need a lot more kind of daily transactional help. And so, again, we try to respond to that as need be. But that also can change pretty significantly and pretty quickly. One of the things I think that we're seeing, just to put some of the concerns that you're seeing in the reports in a broader context, is certainly the effect of some tight resources at the agency level. It's also the effect of some really key retirements across state government. Turnover for some, because of some market pressures, but also turnover as baby boomers, people who've been here for several decades, leave and take the knowledge of the state's financial system with them. We're doing our best to look at how we can capture that knowledge. It also means, I think, that one of the things we've been looking at a lot in our agency is looking at changing the training that we do, because we're really faced with a completely different situation where we have newer people coming in who both need to, again, understand how to transfer that information quickly from the folks that are leaving and also get the newer folks up to speed as quickly as possible. That changes the kind of training and the kind of policies that we want to put in place, and we are looking right now to think about how we can do that better. Just want to give you a kind of a menu of some of the things that we're talking about in terms of how to respond to these issues, and again, the broader context that's making some of those, raising some of these concerns. Again, we need to increase the training and assistance that we provide to agencies. We also are looking at changing some of the ways that we, or strengthening some of the things that we already do. We have been piloting a code of conduct training for agencies for a while. Our agency's recently gone, our MMB has recently gone through it. It basically tries to take some of the specifics put in place by Sarbanes-Oxley and translate those for agencies so that they have a sense of what that really means for them on a daily basis. The key idea that training tries to convey, and I think you've heard some of that from what you heard the auditor say, is trying to look at how do you develop a culture of management so that it isn't just those individual folks in the financial units that see their responsibility as maintaining the highest standards, but it's, again, setting a management culture in each agency that understands that and tries to make sure that on a daily basis, with all of the small decisions they're making, can convey that the importance of those things. You also know, I think, and you'll be hearing more about the Department of Administration's efforts, their SMART initiative, which they've had in place now for a couple of years, provide some training to small agencies, some assistance, some daily transactional help to small agencies, and we're looking at ways that we can both support and expand that going forward. We're also looking at creating an internal control unit in MMB to centralize some of the activities that we have going across the agencies. As again, our emphasis typically in the agency has been on more of that front-end help. So looking at training, looking at best practices, looking at policies, rather than doing the kind of audit work that you hear the OLA talking about, without duplicating the work they're doing and having a much, much larger staff, we're not able to do that back-end work. So again, our approach has been to focus on the front-end. I think we can improve the way that we do that. We also, as I said, in terms of creating an internal control unit at MMB can help to probably make sure that we're exchanging all the information that we have across the agency internally. We have quite a few units within the agency that work with other agencies on a daily basis. We don't always share information as much as we can, either internally or even with the OLA. One of the other things that we've talked about is there a way for us to meet regularly with OLA auditors to talk about what are they finding what are the trends, what are the places where across agencies we see some weaknesses, and we're going to start, we're going to propose that and try to move forward with that kind of effort. We also want to make sure that agencies have the best tools that they can. And so you've heard some about the accounting system. Certainly agree with you. We can't blame this on the accounting system. These issues are things that again, really go back to the agency culture and management. But we can provide better tools in the accounting system than we have now. We're looking, with the new accounting system, we'll be able to automate some of these processes. We're hoping to move that discussion forward soon. And then finally, one of the questions that somebody raised is a really a key one, I think, in terms of with Representative Simon, about what can the legislature do? I'd agree that this hearing in itself is a really helpful thing, and further hearings, again, help to emphasize and clarify for agencies and for us what the key things are that you'd like us to be working on. There's a tremendous range of issues ideas that come forward. We'd like to keep working with you on deciding which of those we should emphasize.
Okay. Ms. Moll, did you want to comment, or are you available for questions, or I'm not sure how you were teaming it?
Mr. Chairman, members, what I'd like to do is make a few brief comments about some of the activities that are currently in place related to the issues that the auditor raised. In the area of incompatible duties, we have historically gone through an annual process with agencies asking them to recertify their accounting system users and review the security access that each of those individuals has been given. We certainly share the auditor's concerns about an excessive number of users with incompatible functions. And this last year, we have added some additional review steps and asked agencies to do some additional work in reviewing their employees that have incompatible functions in the accounting system, removing some of that access where possible, and where that is not something that they're able to do, to take a review of the mitigating controls that they have in place and ensure that those are working as designed. In the area of safeguarding receipts, in addition to a statewide policy and procedures on receipt processing, we also have an oversight role in reviewing requests for exceptions to the current requirements for prompt deposit. And we will, from time to time, get requests from agencies for those deposit procedures, and based on a cost-benefit analysis, occasionally grant an exception for a longer period of time to get receipts to the bank. Those cases are limited, as I say, to where there's a cost-benefit proven. Generally, it's small dollar amounts. Sometimes it's out-state locations with limitations on access for daily deposits. In the area of self-service time entry, we have, as the auditor noted in their materials, some existing reports for agencies to use to identify those exception cases, and we do instruct agencies that they should be reviewing those reports every pay period to ensure that there are not regular cases where the primary approver is not doing the review. I think that this is probably a case where we've had some of the issues prior to having an automated system, and the good news is that with the automated system that we have in place now, we're able to identify those cases where the person is not completing their own timesheet or where the primary supervisor is not doing the sign-off. And so while we have policies in place on how those cases are to be handled, we need to do some additional training or consider other communication to get that message out more broadly. In the areas of both cell phone and travel and documentation issues, those are very detailed documentation issues that clearly finance's role to provide policies and procedures is our responsibility, but where the detailed documentation review and transaction sign-off the agency personnel are in the best position to know whether that travel, that trip was taken, what mileage it entailed, what the cell phone usage can be expected. And so we have not done, we don't get involved in the detailed review of that documentation, but instead provide the overall policies. I think I'll end there and take questions if you...
I think we're going to have to hold on questions to when the committees have follow-up. You'll probably be invited to some of those. We're within just a few minutes of adjournment, and we will make every attempt to benefit of the members to adjourn on time. I do have a couple of thank you, and I do have a couple of committee announcements to make. Be sure you read over the committee procedures, and there is one change for those of you that were on the committee last year that I'd like to point out. That's number 4 if you have them in your packet, but dealing with what some call a 24-hour rule. We didn't really have a 24-hour rule in this committee, but it didn't function particularly well, especially from the standpoint of the staff. A lot of amendments were coming in very late. So we're going to have a 24-hour amendment rule this session, and if for some reason you can't meet that rule, if you check with the chair, I will be, if there's valid reasons, open to perhaps waiving that, because I do like to be flexible. That's why I didn't have a 24-hour rule, but quite frankly, in this committee, with those huge bills going through it, it literally got a bit out of hand with the number of late amendments that were coming in. So that's one that I want to draw to your attention. Otherwise, I think the rules are pretty much what we have as had a committee in the past. And then there's also a footnote. These rules are pending any changes to the permanent rules of the House. As you know, there's a lot of discussion about the permanent rules that are taking place, and so if they would impact on anything that we're dealing with here, we would obviously update that. Now, our next meeting will be a joint hearing with the Tax Committee, and that will be tomorrow at 10:30 a.m. And if you do have a conflict with another committee tomorrow at that hour, just let staff know and you'll obviously be excused. But this deals with the state budget trend study. And one of the suggestions that came out about as a result of some of the work of the Government Ops Committee and so on was to try to have as many as possible joint hearings. And so in this case, we've decided to have a joint hearing, and keeping with that, then always the question is, what committee time slot do you use? And so we will be using the Tax Committee time slot, but we will be using this room, room 200, which is the larger room in terms of accommodating members at the table. So with that, Representative Rucamina, 24-hour rule.
Chair, I'm just concerned you're going to destroy my legislative effectiveness. And, you know, you've always been a very flexible person, and, you know, a lot of times when you see bills come through, you're not on any of those committees, and then all of a sudden you see, you know, somebody or a bill that affects your constituents or whatever, and you have to do it right here. So I know, being the fair person that you are, and being a person that, you know, doesn't really like to have rules.
Kind comments.
You keep an open
obviously
mind.
Amendments to amendments and so on that come up in committee, those will, as in the past, been be entertained. What we're talking about is, you know, the major amendments that come in, where obviously there's been some preparation, and they would just miraculously appear here at In those hearings, we're usually starting at 8 o'clock when we're dealing with the big problem is the omnibus bills. And so we're going to be making every attempt that the staff can get the amendments in the packets But if there's an amendment to an amendment that comes forward, obviously we operate under those procedures. And by the way, in terms of getting a request for a waiver, you are in close proximity to the chair on any given day.
Well, I'll just ask for one daily then. Thank you, Mr.
With that, thank you and meeting adjourned.